You're listening to the 21st Century Change Agent Show. This podcast is for those who are always looking for ways to grow as a person and as a leader. On this show, you'll find no ordinary conversations, as I will be speaking with unique people who are already rewriting the narrative. My name is Barbara Ziga, and I help companies to achieve more by putting their people first. Head to Lake House Consulting website to find out more and subscribe to a bite-sized, hand-picked newsletter from me. Thank you for tuning in and get ready to receive your weekly dose of inspiration. Hello, everybody, and thank you so much for joining me on this Change Agent podcast episode that is dedicated to the Women's History Month. Before we get into the rich conversation that I will be having with my today's guest, I'd like to talk about the origins of International Women's Day and Women's History Month in general. It dates back to a demonstration at the end of February 1909, New York City, after which three German delegates proposed such a day is organized every year. So the following year, an over a million people went into the streets of Austria, Denmark, Germany, and Switzerland. Women demanded that they be given the right to vote and to hold public office, and they also protested against employment sex discrimination. In Russia, for instance, 8th of March is a public holiday, and the origins here stem back to 1917, when on 8th of March in the capital Russian Empire, Petrograd, at that time, women textile workers began a demonstration covering the whole city. And it's often said that this is the beginning of the Russian Revolution. Women went on strike for bread and peace, demanding the end of World War I, the end of Russian food shortages, and the end of Tsarism. The point I'm trying to make while bringing up some of the history here is that this day has more and far broader meaning than just celebration of women and womanhood. Women back then rose up not only for themselves, but for everyone. So I want to reflect on the progress made and to celebrate acts of courage and determination by ordinary women who have played an extraordinary role in the history of their countries and communities. Because these women have created an over 100-year-old movement for women's rights, civil awareness, anti-sexism, anti-discrimination, and promoting equal rights. Though the world has made various advances, no country has achieved gender equality. This year's International Women's Day slogan is Choose to Challenge, which encourages to help forge in a gender equal world by celebrating women's achievement, raising awareness against bias, and taking action for equality. Women's full and equal participation in all facets of society is a fundamental human right. Yet around the world, from politics to entertainment to workplace, women and girls are largely underrepresented. From access to education and rights to land ownership to political participation, women still lag behind men, even in countries where there have been significant efforts to address gender inequalities. On today's conversation, I'm joined by Sally Musa, who is an international speaker, moderator, and a global media presenter. Sally has lived in the Middle East for over a decade now, where she has been a presenter and producer on some of the region's top platforms. As an Arab Australian, Sally is passionate about powerful stories that break barriers, explore diverse narratives, and are part of wider conversations driving change worldwide. So buckle up and enjoy this truly inspiring conversation. Sally, well, welcome on Change Agent Podcast. It's absolutely fantastic to have you here.
It's amazing to be with you, Beba. Thank you so much for having me.
Sally, first and foremost, congratulations to you on being announced as one of the first Arab ambassadors for the legendary Fred Hollows Foundation this week on the International Women's Day. What a time to do it. And what a wonderful achievement and organization to be part of. It must feel very empowering to be seen as a global role model. And I would love to hear a little bit more about your involvement with Fred Hollows Foundation and what it means to you to join them as an ambassador.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I really appreciate you talking about that. Fred Hollows Foundation is a legendary foundation that started in Australia by the incredible Dr. Fred Hollows. So he was an ophthalmologist who could see so much inequality happening in terms of access to eye care. And he was seeing a lot of people who were blind, who were needlessly blind. And you have to remember right now, 36 million people in the world are blind, and 4 out of 5 of them don't need to be. 4 out of 5 people who are blind currently don't need to be. This is an astonishing number to me, right? And so since 1992, when Dr. Fred Hollows passed away, after his foundation was set up just before he passed away, you know, he was very passionate about helping Indigenous Australians to make sure that they were getting the healthcare that they needed to make sure that they could see. Because you can imagine, you know, that gift of sight, it's just priceless. It is incredible. It is just, it's something each one of us takes for granted. And yet so many millions of people around the world simply don't have it. They could be vision impaired. They can't see. I mean, you know, just imagine there are women who cannot take care of their families. There are children who can't go to school. So it impacts communities on so many different levels. And this organization, through their amazing work, where they get to go out into 25 countries around the world and to initiate simple surgeries. The surgeries are so incredibly simple, and usually they cost $25. And then you see, you know, these children, these adults who suddenly they get the bandages taken off and they can see for the first time in a long time. And, you know, this is really important. You know, as we talk about International Women's Day, we have to remember that 55% of those who are blind are actually women. So women are way more affected than men. And not just that, they don't have the access to the services in the way that men do as well. So what Fred Hollows does is that there are some communities where women still can't go out, you know, and go and get access to those services. So they bring female doctors, they train doctors to come to them. They train advocates, you know, people who can advocate for those services. You know, they really are, you know, carrying that responsibility. So for me, it's a massive honor. I cannot even explain to you. It's huge. It's huge for me. And particularly because my dad was an optometrist. He's passed away now, but he was an optometrist. So for me, I grew up with that. I grew up understanding, you know, what it means to have that gift of sight. You know, he was so passionate about his work as well, but it's incredible for me to be able to carry that forward now and to hopefully help so many more people, and particularly women around the world, to get that priceless gift of sight. So it's huge for me. So I appreciate you bringing that up. Thank you.
Thank you for the amazing story. And it's great to hear just how personal it is to you and how you've sort of been raised and sort of nurtured in that kind of environment. And now being part of something much bigger, I can feel the energy that you're emitting when you talk about it and how your eyes light up. It's absolutely fantastic. And you're absolutely right. We do, especially I think in the Western world, where we've got so much access and so much privilege, we do take these things for granted. And this kind of awareness and the stats are shocking, you know, the ones that you mentioned at the beginning, absolutely shocking. And it's just a great, again, platform and opportunity to educate and spread knowledge and awareness about these problems and how you can cure it. Because $25 for an operation, unheard of. Thank you for sharing with us and many congratulations again. And it certainly is well deserved, being, you know, for you to be an ambassador of this beautiful foundation. So I can't wait to see your work happening with this community as well. So before we begin unpacking today's subject, I would love to give you some space to tell us a little bit more about yourself, your journey as an Arab Australian woman, and your current life's work.
You know, it is, it's kind of, it has not been a straight journey. Let's just say that So yeah, I was born in Iraq. I was born in Basra. And my family migrated to Australia when I was 8 years old. And it was very, very interesting, you know, that whole cultural shift that happens, you know, just coming from a completely different background and just being kind of feeling like you're thrown into the deep end and you know, things are very, very different. As we went to Australia, you know, my parents didn't know English at the time. They learned and I was learning. I'd gone to an English school before in Kuwait. But I would sit in my room and I would read to myself. So I would read like the Babysitter's Club and, you know, all of those iconic stories and novels that we had when we were little. I would read them out loud to myself and I would act out the characters and I would really get into it. And I just, you know, remember being looked at as very different and just sticking out like a sore thumb, basically, you know, always being the tallest one with way too much hair, you know, all of this thick black hair that, you know, there's a photo of me it was like the fifth grade or something. I'm literally standing in the middle with the longest black hair coming down on either side. I stick out like it just at the time you kind of it makes for a lonelier experience. But you know what? This is what makes you, isn't it? And for me, I'd always loved art and fashion. And that was everything that I wanted to be. I wanted to be a fashion designer when I grew up. And, you know, I'm an illustrator and I do all of that kind of thing. And I love that world. But again, you know, I never saw myself as actually really part of it because I was overweight, you know, seen as the fat one. I didn't look like the girls in the magazines, right? Usually, you know, they were fair and beautiful and thin. And that was just like, there was a kind of a disconnect, even though I loved that world so much. Interestingly, I got into uni to study fashion design, was doing incredibly well, but it was just like, felt like I needed to do something in life that was really going to make a bigger contribution in the world. And I felt like fashion was really superficial at the time. And it was just like, okay, does any of this really matter? And so I changed degrees to sociology and social policy and wanted to do community work. And I wanted to get out there and particularly at the time, for me, this was around the time, this was just before September 11. And what's interesting right now is that this year we're marking the 20th anniversary of September 11, which is, you know, even as I say that, it gives me chills, really. Because at the time, so I was thinking about, okay, who am I in the world and what's my purpose? And for me, what kept coming up was, you know, me as an Arab Muslim woman, you know, that was a really big turning point at the time where I was discovering what that meant. What does that actually mean to be Arab, to embrace who I am as a Muslim as well? I wasn't really religious growing up, but then I had started discovering, you know, more about my faith and understanding more about that. And it was just something, it was, you know, an intense drive towards that. And I had put on the hijab. And so it was quite a time where I really wanted to discover who I was. And I wanted to discover if there was a community of like-minded people who were Arab, who were Muslim in Australia. And I did. I found that at the time. And then September 11 happened. And then, you know, more and more, it was just like, wow, you know, this is really important. There are so many destructive misconceptions out there about Muslims, about Muslim women. And because Muslim women, particularly those who wear the hijab, they are like flag bearers. You know, you're at the forefront. You represent what we were being told in the media as the terrorist. Do you know? So like literally you would have people who were walking past in the street or driving past and you would get abused. You would get your hijab ripped off. You would get all kinds of things going on. And Muslim women at the time in the media were not represented. They were just nowhere to be seen. There was nobody with an Arab name. There was nobody, you know, who looked different, who was not white, who, you know, was kind of there to speak about what it truly means to be Arab, to be Muslim, to be a woman. And it's, you know, really interesting at that time, this has to be said, I had found the Muslim Women Association. That's what it used to be called. Now it's called Muslim Women Australia because it's a nationwide organization. But this was an organization that was started back in 1983. And I really have to talk about it, interestingly, because as well, the founder, one of the founders of the Muslim Women Association, Hajj Aziza, Muhammad As-Siddiq, she actually passed away. She has just passed away on International Women's Day, which is unbelievable. You know, this, she was actually going through illness and she passed away on International Women's Day. This, you know, it speaks to who she was as a community leader. So she was the mentor of my mentor, Maha Abdo. And so, you know, what she started all of those years ago, you know, I had heard about MWA through the radio and I decided to check it out one day. I just went in, they were having an event. I can't even remember what the event was for. It was just like this small community thing. And I walk in and, you know, everybody's asked to stand out the front and introduce themselves and whatever. So I went out the front and I noticed in the back there was, you know, this woman who, you know, was wearing her hijab and like she had her abaya on, but she had like trainers on, she had joggers on and whatever. And she stood there in the back of the room, just kind of looking at me while I was speaking and kind of telling everybody who I was. And she came up to me at the end and it was the president of the MWA. It was Maha. And that was the first time that I had ever met her. And, you know, she saw things in me that I didn't realize that I had. And so it was through her, there was like community radio, there was a community radio station. And she was like, you should get on the radio. You should go and do a show. And we did. We did a show like, which started in Ramadan. It was called Unity in the Community. And it was just all about, you know, having the voices of young Muslim youth and kids on there and their families and what, and just talking, us talking about us talking about what our dreams and aspirations are, us talking about what our fears are, us talking about what our culture and our faith means to us connecting with the wider community in English, right? Because before that, it was mostly just Arabic programming that was happening, which is fine and great. But we're in a like in an English community. So these programs were just starting to come up. Women like that who can see, who look for other young women and train them up and can see the potential and encourage them and push them forward in places that they didn't realize that they could go. These are the women who give me life. These are the women who, you know, make this world what it is. And it's so incredible.
And it's such a profound and beautiful story. Thank you so much for sharing it, Sally. And what I loved about it is, you know, how you talk about those everyday women who changed the world. Because obviously, when we look at social media, we often see, of course, you know, we celebrate Kamala Harris, we celebrate Malala, we celebrate all of these wonderful women. But there's a lot of women who are moving, who are rewriting the narratives and pushing the needle from the shadows. Mm. And they are changing one person at a time, impacting one community at a time. And those are beautiful stories. And those are the everyday women that we don't celebrate enough in media, unfortunately. But I'm glad that, you know, we can talk about that today and then we can voice and call them out by names and that we can celebrate and say thank you to them. So thank you for sharing that story. But also, you know, you talked about, you know, bigger events and how they influence and shape our own experiences. Obviously, you talked, 9/11 and you know, a horrendous event. But again, I am a true believer they definitely shaped a lot of people's perceptions, experiences, and created bigger purpose. And And it's also crazy how events like this shape perceptions about whole communities, and you reflected on that as well. However, recently, so this week, I read an article about Switzerland, where they have made a social vote that they would want to forbid burqas and hijabs being worn in public places. So I don't think we actually have come that far, especially if we talk about these developed countries, these countries that we look up to and we admire their policy, their leadership, their economy, their political state. And then they go and do something like this. And then you think, actually, we haven't come that far.
Do you know, I did see that and it made me incredibly sad that, you know, that is happening. Somehow it is okay for us to wear masks in a public space because there's a pandemic going on, but it's not okay for a woman to decide to essentially wear something that looks like a mask on her face simply because that's her interpretation of her faith. It just shocks me that after all of these years, we still have to fight so hard to be included. But not just that. What really upsets me is the hypocrisy, because it's often, you know, those same people who impose those kind of limitations who will turn around and look at the Middle East and say, oh, well, look, the women are so oppressed. The women have no voice. The women, you know, they're not allowed to do anything. Have you been to the Middle East? Have you actually seen who Muslim women are and what they do and how powerful they are? Let me just give you the example of the United Arab Emirates, where they've decided that 30% of the cabinet here are women. Let's just like stop and look at that percentage compared to other countries around the world, developed countries. We've just, you know, celebrated Kamala Harris as female vice president. There have been several Muslim countries which have had females as presidents and as leaders of their countries. So we're like, okay, welcome, you know, welcome to, you know, what we've already had for quite some time. And people think, oh, you know, okay, fine. It's progressive. You know, I hate that word, that, you know, somehow we're looking at now progressive Muslims, right? So that's why, you know, women are more involved now. Well, actually, no. Let's take a look back all the way to the time of the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him. His first wife, Khadija, was a noble businesswoman. She was an extremely successful merchant in her own right. She employed the Prophet Muhammad under her, within her business. She saw who he was. She saw his character. She was 40 years old. He was 25 when she proposed marriage to him. Just think about that for a second, whether you would actually see that today and what the reaction would be in a Western, you know, country. People would still look at that and raise an eyebrow. But she was the one who proposed to him. He turns around and goes, well, I don't really have the money, you know, to get married just yet. He was still quite young and trying to, you know, collect himself. She was independent. She made her decisions. She went and married him. She supported him. She is referred to as the mother of the believers. Their love story, they were married monogamously for 25 years until she passed away. It is an incredible love story. That there are so many different accounts of women in battle. There are accounts of women who were there, you know, who were as consultants for policy. So many different ways. I mean, you know, so it always used to and still does upset me so much when I hear people saying, oh, you know, Muslim women are so oppressed. I'm like, you don't know Muslim women. You don't know Muslim women if you think that Muslim women are oppressed. You have no idea. You're speaking from a place that doesn't know who they are or what they do or what they have done for more than 1,400 years. It just astonishes me. It still astonishes me that we're still talking about what a woman wears. You know, Menal Rüstüm, for example, who is a mountaineer and a marathoner, and she established the Facebook group Surviving Hijab, where there are like 100,000, I think, now on that group. Women from all around the world who share their stories, who share their experience. Why should they have to do that? Why are we doing this to women? Why are we still judging women by what they wear? This is, you know, the ultimate freedom for women. And we're still, unfortunately, in 2021 fighting for it. Is to allow women to make the choices that they need to make. That's it. That's all that needs to happen. Because women are more than capable, but somehow we need to keep still putting those obstacles in their path, which hold them back, because we're still arguing and we're still thinking about meaningless, stupid things like what a woman is wearing, rather than the more important, bigger issues in the world.
100%. And I think huge part of it, and we can talk about that as well, because obviously you're in media as well, of actually how the Western media perpetuates this, because they share very particular stories followed by a very particular imagery that often has got nothing to do with the context, which creates very particular images and perceptions in people's minds. You know, the fact that if a woman is wearing a burqa or a hijab, she's been made to wear it. They don't think about the fact that it is her choice to express religion and to do it. You know, and
exactly.
100% agree with that. And I agree also with what you talked about, these double standards that we have. You know, on one hand, we will say, I'm not a racist. I've got, you know, Muslims living next door to me. I'm always nice to them. And then, you know, the next day I'll go and vote against them wearing burqa or hijab. Mm. And those are absolute, you know, double standards. And then you're saying, oh, they are, like you said, exactly, they are oppressed. But actually, you're not really helping the situation, because by that one vote that you showed up to give is actually affecting huge communities. They've got nothing to do with you.
And this is why it's so important to have the representation of Arab and Muslim women in the media. And not just in the media, not just, you know, on radio shows and TV shows and what. And I can't believe, I keep thinking, I've been fighting for this for the last 20 years. There are women who have been fighting for this stuff for a lot longer than me, you know, but we're still here. I feel like we're still in the same place. But we need a wider representation. We need to see women in hijab, you know, who are on TV screens, not talking about Islam and Muslims. You know, even me, I remember like a couple of years ago on the BBC, they had one guest on who wore a niqab, right? So she was completely covered, but she was there as a business expert, right? And even that kind of sort of like blew my mind. I'm like, this is amazing. We have a Muslim woman on television who's completely covered, who is not sitting there defending the hijab or the niqab or Islam or anything. We're tired. We're extremely tired. We just want to be allowed to be who we are and to be who we're supposed to be and to be great at the different things that we're great at. And to talk about that, I don't want to talk about what I'm wearing anymore.
And that's quite interesting. So recently read a female lead's research into working women. And this has shown a light on the persistent problems that block women's careers. And one big issue that they have discovered, I don't know whether I can say discovered, but found, is something that they call the unentitled mindset. And this is the way that women are socialized or conditioned to feel less entitled than men at work, at home, after maternity leave, in all areas of their lives. And this is a toxic internalized bias and mindset that leads to a lack of confidence again at work, especially if we talk about negotiating pay rises, asking for flexibility, promotion. And this research gave insight into the fact that women often feel that they should expect less, not take up too much space, not demand more, even though they deserve it. However, they also discovered changes in many of the narratives and myths that we've had. So, for instance, the women are becoming, when women are becoming mothers, they don't care about their careers anymore. couldn't be further from the truth. The fact that they are afraid to take risks at work, that they feel ashamed of being higher earners than their male partners, again, a myth. So it is great to hear that there has been a huge movement in women's voices when it comes to how women experience the world. However, the way women's experiences are portrayed in media, exactly what you just touched on, hasn't really changed. It's remained more or less the same that it was 25 years ago, portraying women as helplessly mired by every bias out there, be it big or small. And obviously you've been in global media world for many, many years. So I'd love to hear from you and your professional world. How have you seen this mindset and these narratives and these myths manifesting themselves? And more importantly, what are some of the changes and progress that you have seen over the years?
Do you know, I think this is so important to touch on, because this unentitled mindset touches women at all levels. You will hear so many women, you know, talk about, you know, this relates very much to the disease to please as women. Okay. So here's the thing. When girls are younger, what is the thing that they hear the most from their parents? What is the biggest instruction that they are given when they are little? Be a good girl. Be a good girl. This is the thing that you hear the most, which is essentially an instruction to please others. Be pleasing to your husband. Be pleasing to your parents. Be a good girl at school. Make sure your teacher's happy with you. Be a good girl. Don't be disagreeable around your friends or anybody else. Don't take up too much space. Don't be too loud. Don't be too opinionated. Don't rock the boat. Don't ask, basically. This is what girls are being taught from day one. And it's so important because it's the opposite of what boys get told. Boys are told that they should go out there and they should get it. They should get what they want, and we celebrate them when they do. If girls are too loud or challenging or, you know, going out there, they're too bossy, they're too ambitious. You know, you can be called a bitch for being too assertive and too direct in what you want. Women will be asked, how are you going to manage a family when, you know, they come into positions of power and leadership? Or even any position at all. They won't be hired to begin with, because it'll be like, oh, you know, I don't want to invest any money in you because you're just going to get pregnant and run off, you know, after a few months or a few years. So there is that mindset, you know, right from the get-go. And this is the thing that we have to let go of, first of all, as parents. And this is vital. I mean, it relates to so many things because, you know, this is what kills who we are. Because I have to tell you, you know, for me, I realized at the age of 41 that it was not my job to make anybody else happy except for myself. I have to look at what I need. And women, as women, we celebrate selfless women, and this has to stop. Women are not taught to look inside of themselves and to recognize who they are, what their unique talents are, what they want in life. We are never asked, what do you want? Truly, we are never asked, well, what is it that you want? What do you want to achieve? Our worth is only defined by, as women, by our relationship to other people. This has to stop. Our worth is within us and intrinsic and has nothing to do with our relationship to anybody else. There's an Arabic, you know, proverb that says, فَقَدُ الشَّيْءِ لَا يُعْطِي. If you don't have it, you can't give it. If you are not feeling full and inspired and nourished inside, you can't give that to the world. If you're feeling empty and drained, that's all you can give to the world. If you're feeling troubled inside, that's all you can give to the world. If you have peace and inspiration and joy and wonder inside of you, that is what is going to go out into the world. And so to your point of, you know, looking at the role of mothers as well, as a mother myself, you know, my girls are almost 11 and 15. In my motherhood journey, you know, the thing that I have learned is that, my goodness, I have never experienced a love as intense as the love that I have for my children. Never. It is like, it is a love that makes me want to explode. But at the same time, I need to fill my cup. I need to do things for me as well. You need to keep filling your cup, and mothers are not taught to do that. And so we have to teach our girls that they are entitled. They are entitled. This unentitled mindset has to stop. They need to be taught that they are capable. They are limitless. They can do it. And we need to be able to, as women, do that for ourselves first and pass that on to our girls as well. We need the men as well to take note, pay attention. And, you know, I'm so grateful for those men, you know, around us who do speak up for women. So, because here's the thing, when women rise up, everybody rises up. I remember 20 years ago, I was asked to give a speech about women. And so the guy introducing me was kind of saying, you know, that this topic is really important because it affects, you know, 50% of the population. And I got up there and I said, no, this topic affects 100% of the population. Because if our mothers don't have what they need, if our daughters don't have what they need, if our sisters and aunts don't have what they need, if these women don't have what they need, the whole world suffers. Everybody suffers. We cannot give to the world if we do not fill ourselves first. And this is so important. And I love, you know, this is what Oprah says about it as well. She goes, people used to always say, oh, she's so full of herself. And I, you know, and then I was like, yeah, no, wait, yeah, I am full of myself. My cup runneth over. I love myself. Look at what a woman like that can achieve. The more women who speak up and say, this is what I deserve, this is what I need, this is what I demand, then it will become a norm. And until then, it won't become a norm. And we need men on our side as well who will say, this is what's right, this is what's fair, this is how it should be.
I love that. You were giving me goosebumps throughout what you've just said. And I love that piece about being the good girl. And not only being the good girl when we are little, we have to be a good girl even when we are women, when we are yes. full-on women and mothers. We still have to be the good girl, the quiet one. And even now, if we talk about diversity and inclusion as well, organizations want women to be seen in their organizations, but they don't want them to be heard. They got to be the good girls. We've got women. We're going to put them on our PR brochures. They are the sort of the marketing, the stunt women, right? You pull them in when you need them, but you don't want to hear from them because the moment they open their mouths, you know, they get gaslighted, you know, they get mansplained, all of those great things out there. And then they slowly get pushed out or kindly asked to leave. So that still happens today. But yet we are going to go out and be loud and proud about the fact that we need women in our organizations. Well, let them be heard then. Because, you know, you talked about Oprah. She said, yes, you know, I am full of myself. But she has achieved all of that through her own work. But she is powerful. She's up there. But how much is she doing for other people? And yet we've got a lot of men, very powerful, very influential up there, without taking anything away from them. There is more that they could be doing. Because yeah. they are people who influence policy. They are people who shape nations, mindsets, communities, there is so much more they can do.
Exactly.
So that was, when you talked about children, Khalil Gibran, obviously many, many years ago, wrote The Prophet, Lebanese-American poet, he wrote The Prophet. And that's a beautiful, beautiful book. And what he talks about in his book, especially around the passages about children and us as parents and us as being in relationship, and the most profound one, I think, was for me around the children. And what he talked about is we as parents do, and I'm completely rephrasing this, we as parents do not own our children. We are all on our own journeys in this life. The only thing we ultimately need to teach them is to be good people, is to be good parts of their communities, good citizens, ultimately. But we don't own them. We don't own their journey. And it's not our right to be shaping it to our liking or to try and fulfill our unfulfilled desires through them. And that was something really profound. And as we were talking about, you know, the children and how we should be talking to both our girls and boys, that just came to my mind.
I want to pull it out. Hold on. Because I posted that poem and I just think it's really important. And I love it so much. Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you. And though they are with you, yet they belong not to you. It is so, you know, incredibly vital. That is one of the most beautiful poems I have ever heard. But, you know, again, it's reminding us we have to let go and we have to let go of expectations, you know, and that's just so incredibly vital. I have two girls, but they're like night and day. You cannot say that they're, you know, they're supposed to be this and they're supposed to be that. And that, it's been such an incredible lesson because they're so different and I have to let them be exactly who they were born to be, you know. And this is really important as well. You know, one of them is super quiet. She's in the background, but gosh, she's smart and she can see and she observes and she remembers things years later. She remembers details years later. I'm like, how do you even know that? How do you remember that? Right. But she's the quiet one. And then her older sister is so outspoken, you know, you will hear her coming like a mile away. And I used to say to her, you know, Janine, don't be so loud. But now I celebrate that. You know, I want her to be loud. I want her to be who she is. She was born to be fire. She was born to be something completely different, you know, and I have to adjust to that as parents, as human beings, we have to adjust to that. You know, it's not about us. And that's a really big one, you know, when we're talking about, okay, how are we going to change mindsets? How are we going to change the future? This is how you change the future, by completely disconnecting yourself from it. Because you know what? A lot of parents, they're in there and they're like trying to realize their own unrealized dreams through their own kids. Their parents had expectations of them to become a lawyer, a doctor, or whatever it is. It didn't happen for them. So they're going to put that on their kids because they think that is the acceptable, you know, concept of what it is to be successful. No, you have to listen. You have to be there for your own kids and let them be who they are supposed to be, because then that's when they reveal their gifts. That's when they reveal their power. And we have to allow them, you know, we have to empower them to reveal all of that and to discover all of that for themselves. And yep, there might be pain sometimes in that process, but that is part of the growth. That is part of the breaking open of who we are and the growth that we can experience. And that won't happen unless you let them do that and you step back. You have to step back. We all have to step back and do that.
And that's really interesting, you know, as it's really funny, actually, as you were describing your daughters, you were describing me and my sister. We are absolutely these two sort of bipolar creatures, you know, these women. And this is, and again, you know, I'm, a, you know, my sister and the same as your, you know, younger daughter has got such connection with their feminine energy, you know, this ability to receive, to process, and make an impact from their own spaces. And this is really interesting, obviously, because we just talked about it, the fact that, you know, the influencers and the mentors in your life have been doing their movements and their stuff from low-key spaces, but the impact has been global. And this is the thing, you know, whether we are, you know, loud and proud or whether we are absorbers, we can't erase either of those. We can't say that one is better than the other. Those are yin and yang. They don't live without each other. You know, that's the balance. And that's the balance that we have to have in the world.
Oh, Beba, right. I love that point so much, because it's just really vital. And you've touched on something that I've been noticing as well, you know, particularly as we see when we celebrate women and when we celebrate International Women's Day, it's fantastic. You know, I love, you know, seeing all of the different women highlighted and their achievements and that kind of stuff. But, you know, usually we talk about the women who have been loud and have made their voices heard. And these are so important. But just as important are the quiet ones who nobody sees, who are doing the daily, soft, quiet work in the background. Being a mum at home is just as important as being the CEO of a multinational company. And I would love for once for us to really, really understand and acknowledge that, understand the power of what it is. You know, when that mother is raising her children and she's sitting there and she's reading to them that same storybook 20 times over because they have asked for it over and over again. And she's the one, you know, who is, you know, changing the nappies and doing all of that tedious stuff. You know, sometimes, you know, we can belittle stay-at-home moms. We can belittle those who are housewives or whatever. All of that work is important. All of it is important. So, you know, we have to realize that, yes, being out there and achieving and doing, and that's the masculine energy, and that is so important. But so is that feminine energy, because we need all of it. We need to make sure that there are those women who are also, you know, whether it's in the background or quietly, also doing the work. That is still work. You know, being a successful woman doesn't mean that you can compete with men and you can win, you know, in the same race. That's not what being a woman, a successful woman, should be about. That's great. That's fantastic if you want to be at that level and do that, but that's not what it's about. It's about acknowledging every part of who we are. And it's amazing. You know, I was looking at this. It's something I've thought about, obviously, but I saw this. Somebody had posted about it, talking about how women are literally the connection between the spiritual realm and the worldly realm that we see here every day, because we are the only ones who can give birth. And we are the only ones who have the power to be able to go through that process. That is unbelievable. You know, the focus around childbirth is usually just around how much weight did she gain while she was pregnant. Can she get her baby pre-baby body back after she gives birth? You know, oh, she's got the stretch marks and she's got that saggy tummy and, you know, she's overweight in places and got bulges in places that she didn't have before. This is our entire conversation currently, you know, in the media and in general about childbirth. Like, it's insane. It's a literal miracle that happens, that you are able to, you know, we've disconnected from that, the power of that experience and what that means, and the energy and the contribution of women who, you know, can do that and are able to do that. That needs to be honored once again.
That's really profound. And you know, these, again, masculine and feminine energy that you talked about is just literally the first law of nature that we've have completely forgotten about. And, you know, and I could talk to you for hours on this, but I would just love to add just one last layer on top of our conversation, everything that we've talked about, sort of bring it into a bit of an sort of organizational context. So, you know, over the pandemic, for instance, there have been various reflections on which countries have dealt with the pandemic better than others. And upon this reflection, most, if not all, such countries have been led by female leaders, you know, be it Jacinda Ardern, be it Angela Merkel, be it Tsai Ing-wen. And there have been various articles exploring what makes them so great. You know, what characteristics do these women collectively possess that sets them apart from their male colleagues? And the key characteristics were, so there was actually research done on this, and the key characteristics were authenticity, empathy, relatability, and being engaged and active listeners. These women are still strong decision makers. They are problem solvers. They are assertive. They are articulate, confident. They don't shy away from conflict or emotionally charged situations. But when it comes to their execution style, it is much more down to earth and more humane and human centric. And there was another interesting piece done by Harvard Business Review where they conducted research across 100,000 people across the globe and came to a conclusion that, and this research was about female versus male leaders. And the conclusion was that women outperform their male counterparts on 17 out of 19 leadership skills. And this has been determined through 360 feedback. So feedback from your direct reports, peers, and line managers. And I'm not bringing this up to invalidate men or their abilities as leaders, but it's about to pause and ask ourselves, why are there not enough women in these decision-making spaces? Are we succumbing to unconscious bias? Are we automatically giving the nod to a man when there is an equally competent woman? It's just a, sort of an opportunity to pause. How do you see such discrepancies manifesting themselves in the professional world, and how have you seen them manifesting themselves along on your journey? And what do you think is the missed opportunity that has been because of that?
Gosh, that is obviously such a big question, but I want to come back to, you know, what you were talking about, why these female leaders like Jacinda Ardern have been so successful. And I really think, obviously, the pandemic has tested us in ways that the world has needed to be tested. It was, you know, this was inevitable. And it has not only tested us from, obviously, a health perspective, but it has tested our humanity. It has been so incredible to see this pandemic, because it has just really highlighted how interconnected we all are, the entire globe. And I think those leaders who have honored that interconnectedness, they are the ones who have been successful here. Those who have, you know, even before the pandemic, looked to disconnect themselves from the rest of the world and try to put themselves first, they are the ones who have lost. We have seen that literally and figuratively. They are the ones who have lost. Those who are thinking about those connections and thinking about others beyond themselves. I mean, for me, you know, this is a central concept in life. And the Africans call it Ubuntu. Okay. This particular concept, you know, if you say the word properly, it sounds like this: Ubuntu. It is strong, it is powerful, and if you're a woman, you hear it coming from your womb, right? That's where the sound emanates from, Ubuntu. And it shakes your very being. And it basically means, I am because we are. It literally talks about how every single one of us on this planet, in this universe, are literally connected to each other. The decisions that I make every single day will affect so many other people and creatures and things on this planet. And the same goes for every single one of us, right? The energy that I put out into the world, how I speak to you today, Baba, whether I speak to you with a beautiful energy, if I bring you peace, if I bring you joy, you're going to take that out to the rest of the world. If I cut you off, if I am rude to you, if I am mean to you, if I disregard you, you're going to go and take that pain and that destruction out into the world. And on and on and on it goes. There is a ripple effect that is so much bigger than what any of us can see or understand. And it's really interesting around that concept of Ubuntu. There was an anthropologist who went to study African tribes. And he went to these children and he said, okay, I'm going to put this basket of sweets over there next to that tree. So a few hundred feet away from this group of children. And he said, I want you all to race towards that basket of sweets. And whoever gets there first, they will get the whole basket of sweets. So he said, ready, set, go. And what the children did was astonishing because they all held each other's hands and ran towards the basket of sweets together and got there and shared the sweets amongst themselves. He couldn't understand it. He was like, why did you do that? They said, Ubuntu. They said, how can one of us be happy when the rest of us are sad? It's putting yourself not first above everybody else, but realizing that you are part of something bigger and so much greater than you, your individual small self. And this is where we find our life's purpose. This is what gives us purpose, because none of us is here by accident. None of us is here without a purpose. Each one of us is here to make this whole world better. You know, we have our gifts, we have our abilities, and we need to remember that. And what the pandemic has taught us is that we need to have that empathy. We need to help each other out. We need to be thinking of others because we're going to need it. It impacts us. How others are feeling will impact us. It doesn't matter if they are thousands of miles away in a different country, it will impact us. We need to be thinking bigger when it comes to empathy. I think it's just the most vital thing. And particularly as we see a lot of division in the world too. In the Quran, there is this particular verse that I have always held with me, but it just recently, I just felt the impact and the power of it. And it says this, Ya ayyuha an-nas, inna khalaqnakum min dhakarin wa untha, waja'alnakum shu'uban wa qabaila lita'arafu, inna akramakum 'inda Allahi atqakum. It says, O humankind, we have created you from a male and a female and made you into nations and tribes so that you may know one another. And I used to always bring this verse up, you know, when I was talking about diversity and in my speeches and you know, particularly in Australia. And I used to, you know, it used to be a thing just about, you know, it's important for us to be diverse. Because, you know, but then recently I just really thought about it and I'm like, this is the Ubuntu verse. Literally, oh humankind. It's starting with, oh humankind, we have made you into a male and a female. It is so specific. It's not like we've created you. No, there is a male and a female. Where are you acknowledging the female? In you, yourself, but in the world as well. How are you treating your women? Because our success depends on how we treat our women as well. How we acknowledge our feminine energies, because everybody, men and women, and I didn't realize this until a few months ago, but you know, we all have that feminine, masculine energy. And I used to think, oh, I'm feminine, I'm a woman, and I've got the feminine energy. I didn't have the feminine energy because I didn't know how to just be, how to let go, how to receive. Right? All of that. And we have that within us, but it's also about, you know, men and women in the world. What are our relationships like? We've made you into a male and a female and made you into nations and tribes so that you may know one another. We've made you different, but you have to get to know one another. What is it to know one another? To know one another is to go deep. To talk to each other, to try to understand, to put behind our preconceptions and our prejudices, even with people, especially actually with people that we don't know and we don't like. Because if we did that, we would realize that the things that make us different are what bring magic to this world, are incredible. We have so much to learn from each other. But then if we know one another, it's not just the stuff that makes us different that we see that brings color and life and beauty to this world, but we recognize all of the things that make us the same, that we all need belonging, a sense of purpose, that we all have the same dreams and aspirations for ourselves, for our families. You know, there are basic human needs that we all have, and that is what would bring us together. But we're not interested in getting to know one another. We're not interested in breaking down those barriers, and we have to start. And, you know, this goes all the way. So the power of this, when I realized it, it kind of shook me. It really shook me at, you know, just at the core, because this is what's missing right now, getting to know one another. We live in a world that has never been more connected. It is like so easy for us to go online and to, you know, join a group or start talking to somebody who is from a completely different country, from a completely different background, but we don't do it. You know, it's just, it is incredible. We have to be open. Bosses in the workplace, you know, employers have to be open. We have to start listening. Like you said, you know, yes, we have those token women, or we have those token, you know, people of color or diverse groups of people here and there. But are we listening? Are we trying to really get to know one another and get to understand what each of us needs? Is creating change important enough? Is it a priority for us? It has to become a priority for us, because that is the only way that all of us get to grow. That is how all of us grow, if we make sure that everybody is taken care of and thought of as well. And it's not just a sweet, cute, you know, idea. You know, this is literally, our life depends on it. Us coming together, you know, climate change depends on us coming together. We cannot deal with that if we don't collectively come together and deal with that. Dealing with the pandemic will not happen unless we collectively come together and work together. You know, it's just, it's our life depends on it. Economically, we know that organizations that are more diverse, that have more women, do better. And the bottom line, it is just, you know, if you want to talk about money, if you don't want to do it because it's the right thing to do, fine. You know, economically, this is important. Diversity is important. Listening to women, bringing women in is important. That's the only way for all of us to grow.
And I just want to echo what you just talked about, this beautiful quote of, how can one of us be happy when the rest of us are sad? This should just, you know, instead of having all of these values written on company walls, this should be written on company wall. Just to say, right, we all have to come together. And I'm also a strong believer, as you just talked about, is that all women and, you know, any other demographic, you know, we can't rise in vacuum, in isolation. We are all part of an ecosystem, and we are all so interconnected. So it's so important to understand that. It's understand of how I fit into that ecosystem and how we stand up for each other. And it's such a profound thing. And, you know, what you've talked about also in terms of diversity, on how, when we talk about diversity and we talk about, you know, be tokenism, we focus on the differences. Black, white, female, male, obese, you know, thin, educated, has no, all of these things. And, but again, you know, rather than focusing on these differences, we have to focus on the things that unite us and bring all of that together, while still allowing us and creating the space for us to be unique and to be whoever we are.
But it's not just that, you know, because this is a question of justice as well. If we're seeing injustice, whether it's, you know, like look at it at any level, whether it's racial injustice, whether it's injustice against girls, you know, being prevented from learning and participating, whether it's an injustice of, you know, sexual harassment of women in the workplace, or it's the injustice of women not being paid the same as men for the same job, you know, that stops our progress. It just does. You cannot put a PR campaign on top of that and pretend it's going to be great and it's going to be fine. You cannot. It doesn't matter what else you do. If you don't deal with that first, nothing else moves forward. You just can't. So I think it's, you know, as well as that, it's a question of justice has to be part of that framework as well.
100%. And International Women's Day, it's got such a profound and yet varied meaning across the world. You know, in some countries, it's a public holiday. So you've got Russia that celebrates as a public holiday, and there are other countries as well. In other countries, it's been ignored completely. In some countries, people go out protesting. In others, womanhood or the feminine energy that we've talked about has been celebrated. So this year's International Women's Day slogan is "Choose to Challenge." And first and foremost, I think it's, again, a profound slogan, and especially that choose part. The fact that we've got a choice to challenge is a privilege. So whoever have got that privilege of choosing when to and when not to challenge have to challenge. So how are you? I guess I've got two questions for this. Well, first of all, how are you embodying and bringing this to life this year? And, you know, and every day and every year, because, you know, for us, it's a journey every single day. You know, we don't wake up as something else one morning. It's a journey we embark on every single day. And also, what does International Women's Day mean to you and the communities that you're part of?
Oh, I love this year, you know, that it is about choosing to challenge, and there is so much that we can choose to challenge, and that is the thing. It really depends on your current situation or your platform or where you are. And for me, as somebody who has been in media, I've always wanted to amplify the voices of women who are doing amazing things in the world. And I think it's really vital that we keep doing that. And not just women in general, but as we've been talking about in this whole conversation, making sure that we have diverse women represented, making sure that women who wear the hijab, for example, are there at the forefront talking about what they do, who they are, how brilliant they are. And I think, you know, part of choosing to challenge is passing the mic to those women and saying, please tell us your story, you know, so that you may know one another again. You know, we need to hear from them. We need to hear from these diverse voices. We need to be open in inviting them into our circles and asking them, saying, please, you know, we want to learn. We want to expand our thinking. We want to understand better. We want to know what we can do. A person in a privileged position, you have to choose to challenge by saying, what can I do? Put your voice out there, put your hand up and say, what can I do? And ask people, ask those who are concerned to tell you what they would like. Don't go out there and assume. And I think as well, we have to be brave enough to embrace the truth. We cannot look at injustice and then just kind of ignore it. We have to be courageous enough to see the truth, to tell the truth, to hear the truth. Sometimes hearing the truth is very painful, and that's okay. Put your ego aside. It is very hard, and I've learned this as a parent, you know, but sometimes, you know, you think you're, and sometimes it comes from a place of being well-meaning. You know, you do something, but it's completely the wrong thing. You know, hearing the truth from someone about how your actions are impacting them negatively, that it can be very hard to hear, and we have to put that ego aside and be willing to hear it. so that we can then choose to challenge. And we have to be willing to listen to our women and to make sure we do give them a platform where they can speak and give them a safe place to speak, whether it's within our families, okay, whether it's within our organizations, because there is a fear that if I say what I'm feeling and what I'm experiencing, I will be rejected, I will be attacked, I will be persecuted, you know, and this happens at all levels. I will be fired from my job. Women live in fear if they're in a, because the power imbalance is there. They're not in a place of power. Women who are not in that place of power to be able to change things themselves live in fear of being able to change it. And we have to change that. That is what we have to challenge. We have to challenge our ability to face all of this, because we can't challenge anything unless we acknowledge it first and we name it first and we say, this is what's going on.
That is beautiful. And that is, I think, such a also beautiful and profound point to wrap up this conversation that we've had today. And we've covered a lot of ground, but I think there is so much there to listen back to get inspired over. And Sally, you are a real ambassador. You're a trailblazer. You're a role model. So it's been a privilege to have you on my platform. And I'm humbled that you've come here. And the interesting thing is that obviously we were supposed to have a very different conversation today and things didn't work out. But I'm really glad that we still managed to get together to talk about something completely else. But I think this is a much sort of more powerful conversation. And I'm, you know, really glad that it's been you specifically who's been talking about it, because what you've done today, you've inspired, you've amplified the voices of your Muslim sisters. You have amplified the voices of your community. You have challenged some of those narratives that we have. So really thank you for that. And I thank you for coming on this platform and having this conversation with me.
No, thank you so much, babe. Really, I'm truly honored and I appreciate you taking the time as well. Thank you so much.
Wow, what a powerful conversation that was. It gave me goosebumps as we were recording it, as well as when I was listening back to it. We unpacked so much. However, the key thing to take away is that building a sustainable future for all means leaving no one behind. Women and girls are critical to finding solutions to the biggest challenges we face today and must be heard, valued, and celebrated throughout society to reflect their perspectives and choices for their future and that of the advancement of humanity. Please check out the show notes. You'll find some interesting resources there, as well as ways to connect with Sally. I shall leave you with that today, and we'll be looking forward to having you back here again next week when I will be having two guests on talking about the digital natives, or Gen Z. Stay safe and healthy, and until next week,